New revelations out, the U.S. military killed scores of women and children in a 2019 air raid in Syria and then covered it up. Scuffles erupting outside Tunisia's parliament, the capital of Tunis, where opponents of President Said protest his policies. And the Daesh terror group says it's been behind a deadly attack on a police headquarters in Pakistan. I'm Behrouz Najafi. Welcome. The U.S. military has reportedly tried to cover up air raids that claimed the lives of scores of civilians in Syria 3 years ago. According to the New York Times, the military officials went so far as to bulldoze the attack site and remove any mention of the strike in a subsequent probe.
March 18th, 2019. An American F-15 drops a 500-pound bomb on a crowd of women and children in an area near the town of Baghouz in Syria's Deir ez-Zor province. Minutes later, another warplane drops an even bigger bomb, then another, killing the few survivors of the first strike. The initial death toll was put at 70. Fast forward to November 2021. The U.S. Central Command has acknowledged that 80 people were killed in the strikes. While claiming that 16 of the victims were Daesh terrorists, it admits that it's unclear if the rest were civilians. CENTCOM has also defended the attacks as justified and conducted in self-defense, arguing that the targeted women and children could have been combatants. But investigations carried out by the New York Times provide a different account of the incident. According to the Times, a U.S. Air Force lawyer who oversaw the operation believed he had witnessed possible war crimes and notified the authorities. The Pentagon later carried out an independent inquiry into the incident, but the Times says the subsequent report was, quote, stripped of any mention of the bombing. The newspaper also says the reports were delayed and classified, and the attack site was bulldozed shortly after.
So this is one piece that is coming out, very important, because it shows just how criminal the war is and the cover-up that takes place at every level, even when within the Army, those who saw it and have access tried to bring it to light and instead were dismissed.
The report bore a striking resemblance to a U.S. drone strike in the Afghan capital Kabul in late August this year that claimed the lives of 10 members of the same family, including 7 children. The U.S. military initially said it had targeted a Daesh terrorist planning a suicide attack in the wake of the bombing at the Kabul airport that had killed 13 U.S. troops and dozens of Afghan civilians 3 days before. The Pentagon similarly defended the botched strike as a, quote, righteous one.
Daniel Hale, the former U.S. Air Force intelligence analyst who worked with the NSA, who worked with JSOC, is now going to be spending the next 45 months in prison for having let the world know that 90% of the victims of U.S. airstrikes are innocent bystanders, basically civilians.
To put things into perspective, the United States conducted about 1,000 airstrikes in Syria and Iraq in 2019 alone, using over 4,700 bombs and missiles. The official civilian toll for the entire year is 22.
We've talked to Tim Anderson, director of the Center for Counter-Hegemonic Studies, about what this latest revelation means for the U.S. military presence in Syria. And he's saying that there is only one solution to stop these indiscriminate attacks. Foreign occupation forces must leave West Asia.
This is just one of the ones that they admit. And as your report pointed out, there have been hundreds and hundreds of bombings in Syria. And it replicates, as your report said, what had been going on in Afghanistan for 20 years, what had been going on in Iraq, what was going on in Vietnam. So this is just really standard operating procedure for the U.S. occupations of other countries. And as your report also said, there's a man in prison for revealing one of those drone strikes. And of course, let's remember, there's Julian Assange in prison in England for revealing, amongst other things, one of the attacks, similar attacks in Iraq. So it's a constant phenomenon. The only answer to it is the evacuation, the exit of all of these foreign occupations. They have no idea of these countries. They bomb from the air. They don't know the culture. They don't know the people. They never deliver any benefits, as 20 years of war in Afghanistan pointed out, where the Taliban came back where they started. So the solution is to get all of these foreign occupations out of the countries of West Asia. There's no other decent solution.
Breaking news out of Tunisia, where people are turning out in force against the seizure of governing powers by President Kais Saied. Now, right now, a large number of people are gathering outside of Parliament, the capital of Tunis. They're demanding a return to what they see as the democratic path. Scuffles have broken up between police and protesters. Security forces trying to push back the demonstrators from the barricades. Tunisia has been in political turmoil for quite some time. Late September, Saied brushed aside much of the constitution, giving himself power to rule by decree. Just 2 months before that, he fired a prime minister, suspended parliament, and assumed executive authority. Opponents accuse Saied of staging a coup, but the president insists all he wants is to tackle the country's political and economic crises. Now, just one day after a bombing attack that ripped through a police barracks in northern Pakistan, Daesh terrorists now saying it was their job. Police confirmed 2 officers died in the blast. 6 civilians, including a young girl, were also injured. It took place in Bajawar. That's a district near the border with Afghanistan. Daesh terrorists have claimed a string of bloody violence, including attacks on mosques in Afghanistan in the past months. But such attacks in Pakistan have been rare. No let-up in Saudi violence against neighboring Yemen. More civilians losing their lives in the latest bout of attacks. 1 civilian is dead and 3 more got wounded in the first Saudi artillery attack on a border district in Sada'a province. The assault followed an airstrike on the province of Shabwa overnight. That attack left 4 civilians dead. Just a day earlier, 4 more Yemenis were killed in an air raid in Hodeidah. 3 of them were kids. Yemeni armed forces have been making major advances against foreign-sponsored militants in that western province.
In a fresh airstrike carried out by Saudi warplanes against Yemenis, 4 civilians, including 3 children, were killed. 2 others were also wounded in the strike in Tuhaita district in the Hodeidah province. Officials say the attack is a clear violation of the Stockholm Agreement that prohibited airstrikes on the coastal province.
There are many violations committed by the Saudi-led coalition, whether through airstrikes or direct attacks on civilians by the mercenaries in Tuhaita and other areas. The Stockholm Agreement prohibited any military action in the Hodeidah Governorate, but unfortunately, the violations of this unbroken agreement did not stop.
Observers say the international community's inaction towards the continuous Saudi attacks on Yemeni civilians, especially the silence of the UN Security Council, is yet another proof of how Riyadh is bribing its way through the world body.
Through our long experience with the United Nations, it's clear that Saudi and Emirati money plays the most prominent role in determining the decisions of the world body, including the Security Council, the Secretary General, and the UN envoy. There is a clear bias regarding the Saudi-led coalition.
Earlier, Yemen's armed forces took control of several districts in the coastal province of Hodeidah, including the international road linking Sana'a with Hodeidah, after a sudden withdrawal of the Emirati-backed forces.
Regardless of the catastrophic situation in Yemen, which the UN describes as the world's worst humanitarian crisis, the international community keeps turning a blind eye to the Saudi violations against millions of Yemenis. People here believe the inaction emboldens Saudi Arabia to continue its crimes in Yemen. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
Coronavirus figures in Russia are nowhere near subsiding, with the country remaining a hottest spot for the pandemic. Over 1,200 deaths from COVID in the span of 24 hours and nearly 39,000 new infections during the same time. Russia currently has the highest weekly deaths globally, a a first since the pandemic started. The Krim recently enforced a partial lockdown for a period of 10 days, but even that failed to improve the situation. National vaccination numbers remain very low. The country is now planning to introduce health passes for access to public places and transportation. The move is meant to encourage more people to get their shots. Time now for the news review section. Europe facing a growing migrant crisis. The situation is spiraling out of control at the Poland-Belarus border, where thousands of migrants remain stranded for many days amid a bitter political standoff. Migrants, mostly from the Middle East and Asia, are amassed at the EU's external border in Belarus. Poland and Lithuania are refusing to let them in. At least 8 have already died, and fears are growing for the safety of others. The Polish government estimates that around 1,500 people are camped there. Is accusing Russia, an ally of Belarus, of orchestrating the crisis. The European Union is also blaming Belarus, saying it's pushing the migrants toward a border in retaliation for sanctions. Now, Belarus saying it will cut off gas supplies to Europe if new sanctions are imposed. The Russian president is also pointing the finger at Western states, Vladimir Putin saying the political, military, and economic motives are in play. Of things going on there, so let me invite two guests and see what they feel about this. So Steve Keen, economist, author, and commentator, joining from Bangkok. Also we have Alfred Desaias, former UN Special Rapporteur on the promotion of a democratic and equitable international order, joining us from Geneva. Welcome both gentlemen. Beginning with Bangkok. Steve, what are the factors responsible for this? You heard the different officials, everyone blaming each other for this, and there are poor people stranded at the border. Tell us about the factors responsible for this.
Wherever we have political conflict and military conflict as part of that, we've had migration of people. I don't need to tell anybody the extent to which the Middle East is a playground for military conflict, particularly from America, but also with other states thrown in there. So you have poor people that are displaced by having their livelihoods destroyed, and they're forced to move, and they move into neighboring countries. And, of course, that triggers a chain reaction of political consequences. What concerns me, I think this is just, though it's only partially driven by climate change, is going to be on steroids when climate change actually hits. And the way states are reacting right now will make it more likely we have social breakdown out of that rather than a form of international politics that can enable stability to return.
Okay. Now, Mr. Desaias, isn't this a case of chickens coming back home to roost? Because look at the areas where these migrants are mostly coming from Middle East, from Asia. Who has created all that mayhem and chaos in those parts of the world?
Well, obviously we have to look at the root causes, and the United States and NATO have a considerable responsibility for the crisis emanating in Afghanistan, Iraq, Syria, and Libya, etc. So migration crisis must be addressed, but the priority now must be to do something for the people who are freezing, for the people who are hunger. Now, after we deal with that, how about just returning to sanity and doing away with the sanctions? Because the sanctions against Belarus, for instance, they also cripple the economy, as they have crippled the economy of Syria and crippled the economy of Venezuela and Cuba, etc. So lift the sanctions. Sit down, talk rationally, and see how you can help people. And as far as migration is concerned, migration, as you know, is very much, I mean, the entry into territory belongs to the sovereignty of the state. And unlike the Refugee Convention, which does bind most of the world to grant political asylum to people who personally are being persecuted, that does not cover the situation of migration, and certainly not the situation of mass migration. So that should be regulated, and at present we don't have the legal basis to do so. So the main thing is sit down and talk.
Well, what's the solution in your opinion, Steve? You know, migration has been an issue in Europe, especially recently. It's not only one country, you know, it's prevalent in different places. And there are some hard feelings among even some population in some European countries, not only the governments.
Yeah. Well, we haven't seen mass migrations on the scale of those that happened during the Second World War yet. But when those mass migrations occurred, the fact that we knew the migrations were being caused by conflict that these people had no part in, it was a large reason why we had such things as the United Nations Commission on for Refugees, the proper treatment of refugees at the time. So it's so long since the last global conflict that caused a massive scale of people's dislocation that we're blaming the individuals who are being dislocated rather than the factors that are causing it. And I don't think my co-speaker here is quite right. We need to have sit down and talk and accept that the great powers are causing this dislocation, not the people who are being moved. But I see no signs of that becoming the politics of the day. These people are being used as pawns in this conflict, and that won't change until such time as the conflict becomes overwhelming, I believe.
Okay, thanks for your comments. Steve Keen, economist, author, and commentator in Bangkok. Alfred Zayas, a special rapporteur on the promotion of democratic and equitable international order in Geneva. Now moving on, just as the Chinese and American presidents are getting ready for a virtual meeting, officials from the two sides do not seem to be backing away from their stances on Taiwan. Top diplomats from the U.S. and China have traded warnings over the phone, Antony Blinken saying that Beijing needs to stop military, diplomatic, and economic pressure against Taiwan and engage in, quote, meaningful dialogue to resolve issues peacefully. We also have Wang Yi that wants Washington to change its dangerous actions that seem supportive of Taiwan's independence and harm peace across the strait. Now, Washington has angered Beijing with its military support and diplomatic contacts with Taipei. Most recently, a visit by a group of lawmakers to the island. President Joe Biden and Xi Jinping will meet online for a discussion of their differences Monday. And that's a wrap for this edition.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
Hame ba wujood qudde saratani Israel mukhalifim.
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel.
Majh mushtarak hame wahdat ummat islami.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
September 2nd, 2021. On the occasion of the National Government Week, President Raisi and the cabinet members met with Imam Khamenei in the Imam Khomeini Hosseiniyah during the first days after the formation of the 30th administration.
The U.S. occupied Afghanistan for 20 years and brought all sorts of oppression against the Afghan people. They bombarded their mourning ceremonies and their weddings. They killed their youth. They imprisoned many individuals without any reason in different prisons, and they increased the production of addictive drugs in Afghanistan by tens of times. They did all of these but refused to take one step to help develop Afghanistan. In other words, if today's Afghanistan, in terms of civil rights, construction, and other such developments, is not worse than those days, it is not better either. So, the US did nothing. Now that they are leaving, it is in such a disgraceful way. Look at the situation in the Kabul airport, the large crowds, and the problems. They only take those who have cooperated with them over all these years and they wish to take. But there are reports showing that their situation is worse than those who stay. There are numerous problems for them in the centers where they are being kept. This is how the US is.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
In any case, we support the nation of Afghanistan. Governments come and go. All sorts of governments held power in Afghanistan over these years. So, governments come and go. It is the people of Afghanistan who are permanently there. We support the nation of Afghanistan. The nature of our relations with the governments depends on the nature of their relations with us. May God bring the best situation for the nation of Afghanistan, liberating them from the situation and putting them in the best of conditions. I hope that He bestows His blessings on them and on us, God willing. I hope that God bestows success on the Iranian nation and eliminates the problems. I pray that you honorable officials of the new administration will succeed in the tasks that you have undertaken and overcome the problems. I hope that you fulfill your promises, help the people with their problems, and satisfy the people, God willing. The people's satisfaction will lead to the satisfaction of God, the Exalted, as well. Having pure and divine intentions and having the intention to serve will help you. God's mercy be upon our dear martyrs, upon our magnanimous Imam, and upon all those who worked for the sake of God and on the path of the truth. Greetings be upon you, and God's mercy and blessings.
Of Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
سعید پورزا، لندن.
رشا سگلم، استانبول.
سید امین عالمی، کابل.
شهان بات، ایندین ادمنستریت کشمیر.
Around the world with reporters.
Palestinian factions in the blockaded Gaza Strip protested in front of the UNRWA office against aid cuts and demanded the agency scrap the so-called framework agreement with the United States. The framework agreement signed last July is a two-year working plan between the U.S. State Department and UNRWA. The protest comes less than a week ahead of the International Conference on UNRWA that will be held in Brussels under the chairmanship of Jordan and Sweden. The Hamas movement said the agreement exposes Palestinian refugees to grave dangers.
We call on donor countries to provide UNRWA with all necessary funding and alleviate the suffering of millions of Palestinian refugees. We also maintain that the framework agreement will place UNRWA under the U.S. hegemony and undermine the Palestinian refugees' right of return to the land of their ancestors.
The UN agency provides education, health, and welfare services to millions of Palestinian refugees in Al-Quds, the occupied West Bank, the Gaza Strip, Lebanon, Syria, and Jordan. During a press conference, Palestinian factions slammed the silence of the international community over the plight of Palestinian refugees.
Settler colonialist regimes that helped Zionist gangs occupy Palestine and displace its people in 1948 must stop helping the Israeli regime. Upon the creation of the illegitimate Zionist entity, those gangs destroyed over 500 Palestinian towns and villages and committed dozens of massacres against the indigenous Palestinian population.
UNRWA has long been a priority target for the Israeli regime and its allies. Over the past decades, the Israeli regime had been campaigning to defund UNRWA and end its mandate.
The so-called framework agreements between the United States and UNRWA aims to cancel the rights of Palestinian refugees. Palestinians across the political spectrum denounced the agreement. The U.S. wants to turn the UNRWA into a security agency in the occupied territories.
Experts say the so-called framework agreement with UNRWA is an attempt by the United States to delegitimize and depoliticize the issue of Palestinian refugees. UNRWA is a UN agency responsible for the welfare of millions of Palestinian refugees in West Asia who were displaced and dispossessed upon the creation of the Israeli regime. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
Since February, there has been calm at the line of control, a de facto border that divides Kashmir between India and Pakistan. But despite relative peace at the border, the situation in the Indian-administered Kashmir is precarious. There have been daily reports of human rights abuses.
The people of the occupied territory continue to suffer under India's brutal military siege. Extrajudicial killings, arbitrary arrests, and detention of Kashmiri youth, harassment, and custodial torture continue with impunity while fundamental freedoms are suspended and Hurriyat leadership remains incarcerated.
Against this backdrop, a special envoy of the 57-member Organization of Islamic Cooperation, or OIC, is visiting Pakistan. His visit is aimed at getting the first-hand account of the ground situation of the disputed territory. The special envoy met Prime Minister Imran Khan, who briefed him about the current situation in the Indian-administered Kashmir. But the public opinion is divided over the role of OIC on Kashmir.
I feel OIC has played no significant role in the resolution of the Kashmir dispute. The OIC has not pursued the issue at the international level.
Kashmir is a major problem between the two countries. Except for passing a few resolutions, the OIC has not done enough for the Kashmir cause. It should play a more proactive role.
In an official statement, the OIC special envoy expressed Islamic world's abiding solidarity and support to the legitimate Kashmiri struggle for their right to self-determination as enshrined in the relevant UN Security Council resolutions. Kashmir is at the heart of tensions between India and Pakistan for over seven decades. Both countries claim the region in full but rule only parts of it. While Pakistan has granted access to the OIC special envoy to its part of Kashmir, India has barred international delegations from visiting its part of Kashmir. This, Pakistan says, highlights Indian effort to hide human rights abuses in the disputed region. Kamran Yusuf, Islamabad.
Islamic Jihad movement held a massive festival in the Gaza Strip marking the second anniversary of the assassination of Baha Abu'l-Ata, Islamic Jihad commander, who was killed by Israeli airstrikes on his house. Targeting Abu'l-Ata triggered a tough round of violence between Palestinians and the Israeli regime.
We are here to express our support to the resistance front that has never failed to defend us. Palestinians in Gaza are living in a continuous struggle, but this makes us more determined to defend our rights.
Baha Abu'l-Ata was the head of Al-Quds Brigades, the armed wing of Islamic Jihad. Baha was one of the most prominent members of its military wing and played a major role in carrying out operations against Israel.
We will remain steadfast and committed to our oath to our leader, Baha Abu'l-Ata. Losing our commanders won't undermine our resistance. We will resist and won't be hesitant to defend our people and the Palestinian cause.
Palestinians in this event also stressed following in the footsteps of Abu'l-Ata in the battle against the Israeli occupation, vowing to keep their resistance until their rights are restored.
Our message to the Israeli regime is that if you assassinate a leader, there will be thousands of other leaders to continue the path of resistance. The killing of Palestinian leaders won't undermine our will to keep up our fight against Israel.
Palestinians here say that the killing of the leaders won't stop the battle against the Zionists. They also vow to remain committed to their resistance as their only means to defend their rights. Ruba Shavit, Gaza.
New Delhi hosted a third regional summit to discuss the ongoing situation in neighboring Afghanistan. Following the recent pullout of U.S. and NATO forces from the country, the conference was chaired by India's National Security Advisor Ajit Doval and his counterparts from other Central Asian nations. India's National Security Advisor opened the dialogue.
We all have been keenly watching the developments in that country. These have important implications not only for the people of Afghanistan, but also for its neighbors and the region. This is the time for close consultations amongst us, greater cooperation and interaction and coordination among the regional countries.
Top security officials reiterated pledge to work for ensuring safe Afghanistan and what they called free of safe haven for global terrorism. The delegates also called for formation of inclusive government in Kabul, stressing the territory should not be used for sheltering, training, planning or financing terror activities.
This could perhaps be the first time Central Asian countries are coming together on a single platform to not only discuss their role in rebuilding war-ravaged Afghanistan, but also formulate a collective strategies which could promote peace, stability and security in the region.
Issues related to radicalization, extremism, separatism and drug trafficking in the region were also discussed in the meeting. The officials expressed deep concern about the sufferings Afghan people have endured before and after the U.S. fallout. Secretary of Iran's Supreme National Security Council, Ali Shamkhani, stressed on rebuilding inclusive Afghanistan, saying U.S. policies brought nothing but miseries and devastation in the region.
Afghanistan's neighbors need to fulfill its duties to settle the crisis unfolding in the country, including efforts to hold to account the countries behind the current situation there, establish an inclusive government comprised of all ethnicities there, and tackle the humanitarian crisis gripping the war-torn country. The Islamic Republic of Iran is ready to rebuild Afghanistan. Regional partners should also exert pressure on the United States to unblock the financial resources of the oppressed nation.
Security chiefs from Kazakhstan, Kyrgyzstan, Russia, Tajikistan, Turkmenistan, and Uzbekistan also attended the talks. However, neighboring China and Pakistan did not attend the forum, citing scheduling reasons. The first two editions of the event were held in Iran in September 2018 and December 2019. Munawar Zaman, New Delhi.
leaving amid shouts of shame. Israel's UK ambassador, Zippy Hotobly, escorted flower in hand by her security detail to her car as British police ward off peaceful pro-Palestine protesters earlier this week. Hotobly, a fervent opponent of Palestinian statehood, had been controversially invited by the London School of Economics Student Union to a debate on Middle East peace.
As she emerged from the debate, she was met with students and pro-Palestine activists exercising their democratic right to protest. But there was a problem with that. It was a peaceful protest against the ambassador of one of Britain's closest allies with powerful pressure groups in British politics.
That has meant a torrent of criticism and condemnation from the pro-Israel media and government ministers. From the British Foreign Secretary, who has called the protest unacceptable, to the Home Secretary, who has described it as disgusting and anti-Semitic.
Where is the evidence for this? People were opposing the Israeli policy at one, and secondly, this particular ambassador who actually says there is no such a thing as Palestinians. Every inch of the land belongs to the Israelis. So by that definition means that this is encouragement to ethnic cleansing.
Once again, an expression of solidarity for Palestinians portrayed as anti-Semitism. One of the targets of that labeling, the chair of the Islamic Human Rights Commission himself, who has spent a lifetime calling out the Israeli regime's repressive apartheid against Palestinians.
What do? They actually try to be sort of racist towards others, use the only tool that they could possibly use of saying anti-Semitic, and then sort of trying mud at everybody else who's trying to stand up for justice and say, this is standard, this type of person should not be given a voice. If you look at genocide and ethnic cleansing, it always starts by denying people of their right to live where they are living.
It's a curious thing about freedom of speech and of expression in the UK. While it's free against some, it's restricted against others. Saeed Puriza, London.
Iran's Deputy Foreign Minister for Political Affairs and the country's chief negotiator, Ali Bakhari Khani, visited London for high-level talks ahead of upcoming negotiations in the Austrian capital that have stalled since June of 2021. It was the first official visit of a high-ranking Iranian diplomat to the UK Foreign Office in some time.
I met with a number of UK Foreign Ministry officials today. We had comprehensive discussions on bilateral relations, regional issues, and also future negotiations.
The long and complicated history between Tehran and London means there are always matters up for discussion. But topping the agenda this time around are the sanctions removal talks due at the end of the month. The Islamic Republic has underlined its position as not simply a return to the negotiating table, rehashing previously decided matters.
The main purpose of these talks from the Islamic Republic of Iran's standpoint is to lift the illegal sanctions imposed on the Iranian nation by the U.S. government in blatant violation of the JCPOA and the blatant violation of U.N. Security Council Resolution 2231.
Having been in Europe for the better part of a week, relaying the Iranian perspective was paramount.
I've had good conversations with the political officials of France, Germany, and the UK in the past 3 days. At the same time as being straightforward and serious, those conversations were clear and progressive. I shared our perspective on the necessary framework for the upcoming talks in an unequivocal and very transparent manner.
Iran has already stated its willingness to deliver a good agreement, but that might hinge on the willingness of the remaining parties to honor the existing terms and walk back the failed maximum pressure campaign initiated by Washington after their unilateral withdrawal back in 2018. More will be clear when all the parties meet on November the 29th. Amina Taylor, London.
Hezbollah Secretary General stressed that the resistance in Lebanon has prevented full U.S. hegemony over Lebanon
and has prevented civil war. Underlining the achievements of the resistance, Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah said that one of the most tangible results is the fact that Israel is deterred from launching aggressions and even fears the strength of the resistance.
For the first time, Israel is living in a deeply rooted state of fear and concern for its existence. The elites in this entity are asking about the legitimacy of the entity's existence and the ability to exist. They are trying to get some oxygen through normalization of ties with some Arab states, but deep in their minds, the Israelis know that all these countries cannot protect their occupation or forts from the men of the resistance in Lebanon and Palestine and the entire region.
Speaking at Hezbollah's Martyr Day celebration, Nasrallah said the main fear for the Israelis is that the resistance in Lebanon would invade the Galilee in northern occupied Palestine. Sayyid Nasrallah also criticized the Saudi campaign against Lebanon, saying a sovereign state would not accept any foreign dictates. The real problem is the crisis the Saudis have in Yemen, he said. The only way to stop it is to accept a ceasefire and lift the siege. Representatives of Lebanese political factions consider that the sacrifices of the martyrs of the resistance in Lebanon are evident for the entire region.
This is a historic day, not just for the resistance in Lebanon, but also for all the people from the Islamic Republic of Iran to Yemen to Iraq to Syria to Lebanon to Palestine. Had it not been for the martyrs, the entire region would have been destroyed. The Zionists and the Takfiris are the same, supported by the U.S. and Arab regimes. But we believe this sacred blood will liberate Palestine.
Families of the martyrs, for their part, stressed that they would not back down.
The blood of our sons bore fruit, and we cannot back down now despite all the campaigns against us. Our children and grandchildren will continue to sacrifice their lives.
Sayyid Nasrallah also reiterated that as the resistance liberated Lebanon from Israeli occupation, their next goal is full sovereignty and freedom from U.S. hegemony.
What began with the first martyrdom operation in November 1982 as a fight for freedom from Israeli occupation in Lebanon has transformed into a struggle for emancipation for the entire region. And what used to be a grassroots resistance in a small Mediterranean country is now backed by an alliance on a regional scale, ready to face new U.S.-Israeli threats. Maryam Saleh, Beirut.
This was the first visit by Afghan interim foreign minister to Pakistan. The fact Pakistan provided its plane to Amir Khan Muttaqi highlights the precarious economic situation the Afghan government is facing at the moment. Muttaqi met Pakistan Prime Minister Imran Khan, who assured all-out support to the people of Afghanistan in the wake of worsening humanitarian and economic crisis.
There are a number of issues which Pakistan and the Afghan government, especially the Taliban regime, they will be talking about, particularly engaging with the world. And you know, Taliban are ready to get engaged with the world.
The visit of the Afghan interim foreign minister was coincided with a meeting of top diplomats from Pakistan, Russia, China, and the United States. Known as Trika Plus, the special envoys of these four countries discussed the current Afghan situation. They also met the Afghan interim foreign minister.
This was the first time that top diplomats from Pakistan, Russia, China, and the United States together held talks with the Afghan interim foreign minister. Amir Khan Muttaqi was informed about the expectations of the international community from the Taliban government.
A joint statement issued by the Trika Plus reminded the Taliban of its promises they made with the international community. The Afghan foreign minister was told that the Taliban need to form more inclusive and representative government. At the same time, the Taliban government was reminded of its commitment to cut ties with all terrorist groups. But Pakistan, Russia, China, and the U.S. favor engagement with the Taliban government.
We believe Taliban are interested in engagement as they seek international acceptance and support. It is therefore crucial that the international community avoids repeating mistakes of the past and continues with positive engagement.
The four countries expressed deep concern over the humanitarian crisis in Afghanistan and promised to extend all possible help, while the U.S. has refused to unfreeze $9.5 billion Afghan central bank assets. But there is no indication if any of the country is willing to recognize the Taliban government yet. Kamran Yusuf, Islamabad.
scores of surveillance bunkers, checkpoints and frequent frisking of residents and vehicles have made life difficult in Indian-administered Kashmir. Following the deadly October violence in and around Indian-administered Kashmir, New Delhi has tightened security in the region. More than 20,000 paramilitary forces, CRPF, and some 5,000 border security forces, BSF, have been called into action. The paramilitaries have occupied locations in the residential areas, a move that has raised concerns among the residents.
It's a serious life threat to all of us. The entire neighborhood will collapse if any sort of unexpected incident happens.
Authorities say these measures are taken to avoid further civilian deaths.
Deployment.
Forces have been in Kashmir since 1947. The only reason to call the additional forces sometimes is to make Kashmir secure for its residents. Bunkers are constructed against potential terrorist acts. Last month, around a dozen civilians were killed. The presence of forces will therefore ensure a sense of security among the residents.
However, residents complain about the humiliating and disrespectful behavior of the security forces.
In Gujarat, authorities should accommodate or relocate the entire neighborhood. The presence of troops around our homes has made us gripped. Not only this, the usual frisking on roads is also disturbing our mental peace, and we are often being humiliated. The entire population is looked at through the prism of terrorism and terrorists.
Kashmir is the world's largest militarized zone and the longest pending dispute. India and Pakistan have fought wars over the territory since the partition of the subcontinent in 1947. The two countries rule the region in parts but claim it in full. After the abrogation of Kashmir's special status in August 2019, New Delhi promised equality to the people of Kashmir. Analysts say 2 years on, people of Kashmir have instead developed a deeper sense of insecurity and alienation. And so far, New Delhi has done least to address their grievances. Shahan Abad, Indian administered Kashmir.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
This is
for a better life.
For a better life.
Farmud Bu'istu li'utammima makarim al-akhlaq.
The Holy Prophet of Islam says, I've been sent to complete noble manners.
Sheikh Javed Akbari, the researcher on Islamic studies from Seminary of Qom.
A'udhu billahi min ash-shaytanir rajim. Bismillahir rahmanir rahim. Dear brothers and sisters, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. You are welcome to your program For a Better Life with me, Javed Akbari. In this episode, we are going to talk about akhlaq in life or ethics in life. Of course, the word akhlaq has been translated differently by different scholars. Generally speaking, the word akhlaq is the practice of virtue, morality and manners in Islamic theology. The word akhlaq is most commonly translated as disposition, nature, temper, and it has also been translated as ethics, morals or manners. And obviously a person with a good akhlaq or with a good morality is a person who has good manners. So he behaves well and he is known as a good character in society. Now, some of you might be interested in understanding the word akhlaq, in understanding the root, of course, whether the word akhlaq is the plural form or the singular form. I should tell you that the word akhlaq is the plural of the word khulq, which means disposition. Now, disposition actually is faculty of the soul. Generally, we use the word malaka to describe a trait of the soul. So disposition is actually a faculty of the soul which unconsciously inspires activities. Now, as I said, We usually use the word Malaka in Arabic or in Farsi. So the word Malaka comes into, not the word Malaka, but the Malaka itself actually comes into existence through repetitive practice. And of course, it's not destroyed easily. Once the Malaka is established, once this faculty of the soul is established, then it does not fade away. Now, a particular faculty of the soul or a particular Malaka may appear because of a habit formed by continual repetition of certain acts, which obviously leads to a certain disposition. What is very important is the repetition of certain acts, which ultimately or finally leads to a certain disposition.
We were given so many prizes. We changed the desert into oases. We built buildings of different lengths and sizes. And we felt so very satisfied. We bought and bought and couldn't stop buying. We gave charity to the poor cause we couldn't stand the crying. We thought we paid our dues, but in fact, to ourselves we're just lying. Oh, I'm walking with my head lowered in shame for my place. I'm walking with my head lowered for my race. Yes, it's easy to blame everything on the West, when in fact our focus should be on ourselves. I'm walking with my head lowered in shame for my place. I'm walking with my head lowered for my race. Yes, it's easy to blame everything on the West, when in fact our focus should be on ourselves. Is it satisfied? Is Allah satisfied? Is Allah satisfied?
Malaka actually is formed through practice and conscious effort. Practice and conscious effort. If the practice and conscious effort are persistent, they will eventually produce a disposition. Now, disposition is not created overnight, you see. If you want to, for example, be a pious person, you should have the faculty, you should have the disposition. And that disposition is not created overnight. It comes into existence by and by, and with the passage of time, provided that, obviously, the person has the determination and the resolve to change himself and to make himself better, you know. Man is a free agent. He exercises free will. He has the volition to change himself because he is not actually living a life led by instincts. No, he is a free agent and he exercises free will. He exercises free will. So man changes his life, his habit and manners by making conscious efforts. When he is making efforts to change himself, he is doing it consciously. He knows in the back of his mind that he is trying to change himself. Sometimes, of course, a man's habit is formed by the environment in which he lives. Because if you put yourself in an environment which is either good or bad, so depending on the environment, sometimes the environment is good, sometimes it's bad. So it is the environment that shapes, of course, your character or the character of a child. Especially a child is more vulnerable and more susceptible to the environment or the setting in which a child lives, whether the environment is created by the family or it is the society that creates the environment. At the end of the day, it is the environment that shapes his character and his personality. Obviously, a person cannot escape the influence of the environment. Whether the environment is good or bad, it will have an impact on your conduct and on your behavior. Now, children and youngsters are more vulnerable. They are susceptible to the influence or to the impact of the environment. And environment has its impact on you willy-nilly, whether you want it or not. So It has its impact. Sometimes you make your own independent and conscious effort to change your life, to better it, to improve it, to live a better life. Because you have the capacity to change it, you have the ability to change it. You have been gifted with the power, with the will, with the resolve to change your life, to make it better, to change your personality, and to live a life characterized by ethics, by morality, by goodness, and by moral values, of course.
Is it satisfied? Is Allah satisfied? Is Allah satisfied?
When we speak of man's capacity to change his dispositions, we do not mean he should destroy his instincts. We do not mean he should suppress his instincts or his, for example, desires. Of course, the desires are there, the instincts are there, and sometimes those instincts can actually overpower the individual. But living a life or changing one's position and the capacity to change one's dispositions, of course, does not mean that we should destroy our instincts. We should, of course, take care of those desires. We should take care of those instincts and make sure at the same time that they do not mislead us, that they do not lead us away from the right path. And because instincts can do this. The instincts, if they spiral out of control, they can actually lead a person out of the right path. So it is very much important that one should try to maintain moderation and not to go to extremes, and of course to control his instincts, and of course make at the same time deliberate and conscious efforts to change his life, to create a change, a positive change in his life. The Holy Prophet, peace be upon him, and his family, has been reported to have said, the most complete of believers in Iman, in terms of Iman, are those who are best in character. So, and of course, it has also been reported from Imam Hassan alayhi salatu wassalam, and this is the last hadith with which I would like to conclude this episode. Inna ahsan al-hasan al-khulq al-hasan, of course, which I roughly translate as the best of good things is good manners. With this, we come to the end of this episode. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Every grain of sand in every desert land he knows. Every shade of palm, every closed hand he knows. Every sparkling tear on every eyelash he knows. Every thought I have and every word I share he knows. Allah knows.
Communicate.
The United States is appealing a British judge's decision not to extradite Julian Assange, the Australian journalist and founder of WikiLeaks. In January, Judge Barretzer found that U.S. prison conditions would be too oppressive and that Assange would be likely to take his own life. In response, the United States has taken to the High Court to contest her findings about Assange's health. In addition, the United States has offered up diplomatic assurances, saying that it won't put Assange in oppressive prison conditions, which doctors have said would lead to suicide. So what exactly are these diplomatic assurances that the United States has offered? And can they actually be trusted? How come Assange's health is the center of the discussion when scores of legal experts, academics, journalists, and historians have all warned that this indictment currently poses the biggest threat